From the campus of the University of Mississippi to the streets of Algiers, and from outer space to the halls of the United Nations and St. Peter's Basilica, these are the sounds and voices that made news in 1962.
Répondre à ce que je vous demande.
Rigo et causa concili ecumenici vaticani secundi.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over.
A strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
This is Bill Scott, Director of News for Radio Press International. 1962 was the year of the East-West confrontation, when both sides, armed with weapons of total destruction, approached the brink of world conflict, and at the fatal moment of decision, halted short of war. The reporters who covered that story, and the other stories that marked man and his future during the year, now recount the forces and events that shaped 1962, Year in Review.
The new year 1962 came in with Nikita Khrushchev feeling his multi-megaton muscles, his hands caressing Berlin by the throat, the maniacal Fidel Castro, his persecution complex fed by the Bay of Pigs invasion, shouting imprecations at the Yankee imperialists, and John F. Kennedy entering his second year in office at the threshold of major decisions that might bring a turning point in the Cold War. This is Irv Chapman, White House correspondent for Radio Press International. At his first news conference in January, President Kennedy told us that his major disappointment of the year gone by was the failure to end nuclear testing. Instead, the Soviets had just concluded a two-month series of more than 40 nuclear explosions, which the president was informed reflected substantial gains in weaponry. On March 2nd, Mr. Kennedy made his reluctant decision.
We shall go ahead with our talks, striving for some new avenue of agreement, but we shall also go ahead with our tests. The basic lesson of some 3 years and 353 negotiating sessions in Geneva is this, that the Soviets will not agree to an effective ban on nuclear tests as long as a new uninspected moratorium or a new agreement without controls would enable them once again to prevent the West from testing while they prepare in secret.
As the president spoke, another Geneva conference was imminent. Secretary of State Rusk was sent to Geneva with instructions to seek a test ban as a matter of the highest priority. The effort was fruitless, but the Geneva conference also provided an opportunity for Rusk to discuss Berlin with Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko. Nikita Khrushchev continued to threaten to sign a treaty with his East German agents at any moment, following which the Western military presence and right of access would be seriously threatened. The Allies firmly rejected Soviet designs, and Khrushchev looked around for a new way to play his game of nuclear stick-em-up. He began pouring military equipment and personnel into Cuba. President Kennedy initially saw no danger to this nation's security.
These new shipments do not constitute a serious threat to any other part of this hemisphere.
The president was badgered from Capitol Hill to take some kind of action, but he continued to interpret the Cuban buildup as defensive. Until on Sunday, October 14th, aerial photographs were handed him showing the first signs of missile bases under construction. Mr. Kennedy ordered the surveillance intensified as he went about his business for the week. On Saturday night, he made a scheduled political speech in Chicago, but then he canceled the rest of his campaign weekend to return to Washington. The time for action was at hand. The administration worked under the heaviest curtain of secrecy in a dozen years. Until on Monday, October 22nd, the president announced his fraught-with-peril decision to the world.
This sudden, clandestine decision to station strategic weapons for the first time outside of Soviet soil is a deliberately provocative and unjustified change in the status quo, which cannot be accepted by this country. If our courage and our commitments are ever to be trusted again, by either friend or foe. To halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, where they're found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities. And I trust that in the interest of both the Cuban people and the Soviet technicians at the sites, the hazard to all concerned of continuing this threat will be recognized.
At the United Nations in New York, Ambassador Adlai Stevenson put the American case before world opinion. Secretary Rusk got the approval of the Organization of American States. The Soviets, taken aback, ordered their ships en route to Cuba to slow down. Then a dozen turned back, and one tested the U.S. blockade. Pentagon spokesman Arthur Sylvester made the announcement.
The first Russian ship that proceeded through the area patrolled by our Navy forces was a Soviet tanker. It was ascertained by the U.S. naval vessel, which intercepted her, that the tanker had only petroleum aboard.
Messages were flowing back and forth privately between Washington and Moscow. But then Saturday morning, Nikita Khrushchev, in a statement disseminated by the Soviet wire agency TASS, suddenly proposed a swap of U.S. bases in Turkey for his base in Cuba. Reporters jammed the White House news office to get President Kennedy's response, the atmosphere electric. The tension of the moment reflected in the vocal cords of Press Secretary Pierre Salinger, who read us the statement.
Work on these offensive weapons continues at a rapid pace. The first imperative must be to deal with this immediate threat under which no sensible negotiation can proceed. It is therefore the position of the United States that as an urgent preliminary to consideration of any proposals, work on the Cuban bases must stop.
The next move was Khrushchev's. He surveyed the situation, the effectiveness of the American blockade, the heavy military buildup in South Florida, the resolution of the young American president. Khrushchev backed down. The president welcomed his move with malice toward none and charity for all, reflected now in the relaxed manner with which Salinger read us Mr. Kennedy's response.
I welcome Chairman Khrushchev's statesmanlike decision to stop building bases in Cuba, dismantling offensive weapons, returning them to the Soviet Union under UN verification. This is an important and constructive contribution to peace.
And with that, the tension was broken, and Mr. Kennedy went to Glenora for Sunday dinner with his family. Continued American aerial reconnaissance during the week ahead showed that the Soviets were indeed dismantling their Cuban bases. The missiles were crated and put aboard Russian ships as deck cargo. American helicopters counted. The controversial veil of secrecy began to lift, and the Pentagon belatedly flew reporters to the Guantanamo Naval Base, where we saw Marines preparing strongly fortified positions against any future Cuban attempt to drive them off the base. American negotiators Adlai Stevenson and John J. McCloy pressed the Soviets to withdraw their Ilyushin jet bombers from Cuba, and only then, a month after he instituted the quarantine, did the president end it.
I have today been informed by Chairman Khrushchev that all of the IL-28 bombers now in Cuba will be withdrawn in 30 days. I have this afternoon instructed the Secretary of Defense to lift our naval quarantine.
Those of us on the scene in Washington during the crisis weeks could not but be impressed by the air of calm and confidence with which the government and officials high and low acted. In the wake of Cuba, they continued to fear that Khrushchev would seek to get even in a spot where the West was vulnerable, such as Berlin. He had promised to postpone action there until after the American election. But such fears did not materialize, and Khrushchev showed the effect of the Cuba events on him in a speech to the world's communists, in which he warned that if America was a paper tiger, watch out for its nuclear teeth. So, as Mr. Kennedy repaired to Palm Beach for his year-end holiday, the post-Cuba world appeared a less frightening place in which to live.
1962 will be remembered by most people in Europe as the year of the Cuban crisis. This is Noel Bernard, Chief of Radio Press International's London Bureau, reporting on 1962 events which made news in Europe, Africa, and Asia, and the effect of the Cuban crisis on people in the Eastern Hemisphere. As the American fleet blocked the maritime lanes leading to Castro's Cuba, the world faced the gravest danger since the Second World War. While the United States was building up its forces in Florida, in Moscow, Mr. Khrushchev ordered the armed forces of the Warsaw Pact to stand by for possible action. The world's greatest military powers, with nuclear arsenals big enough to destroy most of the civilized world, were headed on a collision course. There was no letter in the alphabet for the type of Caribbean hurricane that might have been unleashed. Late on a Sunday afternoon in early November, Mr. Khrushchev gave in. First rockets, then bombers left Cuba. As the year ended, the crisis, too, seemed on its way out. The world, at least for a while, was going to have a mañana. Berlin was the other point of acute confrontation. The West's problem, how to convince the Russians of the dangers of miscalculating the West's resolve to defend its rights and those of West Berlin. President Kennedy started the year by declaring the West's determination to defend Berlin in his State of the Union address. His warning to the Soviets was echoed by West German Defense Minister Franz Josef Strauss.
I am firmly convinced that America sticks to her commitments, and I know if that would not be true, we would have no chance to maintain Berlin as a part of the free world.
West Berlin's mayor, Willy Brandt.
All those concerned have to realize that the solution of this problem cannot be achieved by unilateral changes such as proposed by the Soviet Union.
While the diplomatic situation in Berlin was mostly static, other things were not. The communists reinforced their wall, making it more difficult, but not impossible, for the East Germans to escape to freedom. These attempts to flee the communist half of the city resulted in a number of incidents along the wall. In August, one such incident found West Berliners raising their voices in protest against both the communists and the United States. In a demonstration of inhumanity, the communists shot would-be escapees as they raced across the no-man's land between East and West Berlin, then let them lie there as they bled to death. The Germans decried both the communist brutality and the West's failure to aid the wounded escapees. As the year ended, the pressure appeared to ease, and both East and West seemed to feel that to jaw-jaw is better than to war-war. On the other side of the world, communist China decided to prove to India that non-alignment and coexistence were not Peking's cup of Chinese tea. From the roof of the world in Tibet, across the Himalayas, the Chinese armies poured onto the plains of India. In a swift, impressive, and ruthless campaign, the Chinese human waves made mincemeat of India's ill-equipped and ill-prepared armies. Then, suddenly, at the height of their victorious southward march toward the rich plain of Assam, the Chinese unilaterally stopped firing and executed a partial retreat. The diplomats stepped in again to argue endlessly about the uninhabited strips of territory between the world's most populous nations. But in the world's many dark corridors, there were in 1962 at least two shafts of light. The three princes of Laos at last reached agreement on a government of national unity, and the fratricidal struggle in the remote Southeast Asian kingdom came to an end. In Algeria, too, a struggle ended in 1962 over the opposition of right-wing military and political leaders who made their influence felt in the streets of Paris as well as Algiers. French President de Gaulle moved men and events to bring independence to Algeria. In the streets of Algiers, on a sunny July day, a frantically happy nation, which had suffered more than any other since the Second World War, celebrated its hard-won independence. Although an internal struggle for power ensued, Algeria was able to resolve it and take its place in the community of nations. Throughout the year, the single-minded president of France pursued his goal of building the unity of Western Europe with the cement of Franco-German reconciliation. Chancellor Adenauer visited France during the year to consecrate the new alliance in historic Reims Cathedral. Then de Gaulle crossed the Rhine for a similar ceremony in the ancient cathedral of Aachen. Amid scenes of unprecedented pro-French demonstrations, the president of France addressed the Germans in their own language. While building a bridge over the Rhine to link France with her old enemy, Germany, de Gaulle was suspected of trying to widen the English Channel, separating France from an old friend, Great Britain. Prime Minister Macmillan's attempt to negotiate Britain's entry into Europe ran into heavy seas. Was Britain being forced to choose between Europe and the Commonwealth? That was the main question in September, when the prime ministers of the Commonwealth met in London. Said Prime Minister Macmillan,
"It has its political implications. But while close cooperation is involved, there is no question of our being asked or expected to accept any system of a federal character involving the sovereignty in the true sense of the word of the Crown and government and people of these islands."
But increasingly, opposition leader Hugh Gaitskell and many others disagreed.
"If we are to go into a Europe which is to rival Russia and America and lose our own identity, as we should have to if it is to be such a power, then that is not only the end of Britain as an independent nation, it is the end of the Commonwealth as well."
At year end, Britain's entry still looked like a 50-50 proposition. While Western Europe was striving toward unification, the Catholic Church, too, became aware of the need for greater unity between the world's churches. In Rome, Pope John summoned the first ecumenical council in almost a century, and on October 11th in Rome, amid scenes of great splendor, he proclaimed it open. While the church prayed and the diplomats talked, the nuclear menace did not recede. In Geneva and in New York, East and West tried to put an end to nuclear testing. But the Russians refused to yield on the crucial issue of inspection and verification. At year end, the nuclear deadlock remained unbroken.
Tucked away in hilly, wooded northwestern Mississippi is a 640-acre campus known affectionately by the state's residents as Ole Miss. It looks like a peaceful spot. This is Herb Brubaker, Radio Press International. When I first arrived on campus Friday morning, September 28th, open conflict seemed imminent. James Meredith, Negro, was seeking admission to the institution. He claimed it was his right under the Constitution's 14th Amendment, and the Supreme Court backed his position. Twice, Meredith, escorted by federal marshals, tried to register for the fall semester, but was turned away by state officials under orders from Governor Ross Barnett. Hundreds of troopers and sheriffs from across the state were in town to see to it that Meredith would never get into the university. The U.S. government was equally determined to secure the Negro's admission, but when and how it would try again, no one was sure. As it turned out, Friday and Saturday were quiet. We newsmen had time to talk to the townspeople. Surprisingly, not everyone was behind the governor. The Reverend Duncan Gray, pastor of St. Peter's Episcopal Church, a man born and raised in the state's Delta area, thought segregation was wrong, legally and morally.
"Well, I can't help but believe that the fiasco we are going through at the moment can do nothing but harm the state of Mississippi, the University of Mississippi, and certainly our own community of Oxford."
The harm Reverend Gray feared came Sunday night.
"This is Reverend Gray at the University of Mississippi campus, where there is a tremendous riot going on. Tear gas has just been fired at angry students. Students protesting the registration of Negro James Meredith at this campus a little while ago. A photographer's camera was smashed, and so was his car, and he was escorted over and off of the campus by police. This is the most amazing sight this reporter has ever seen."
The outbreak came as President Kennedy broadcast a special message to the people of Mississippi.
"Mr. James Meredith is now in residence on the campus of the University of Mississippi. This has been accomplished thus far without the use of National Guard or other troops, and it is to be hoped that the law enforcement officers of the state of Mississippi and the federal marshals will continue to be sufficient in the future.
But marshals weren't enough. As dawn broke, hundreds of federal troops and National Guardsmen were rushed to the campus to quell the night-long rioting. Newscasts that morning sounded like this.
The Ole Miss campus has become a battlefield. Federal marshals, National Guard, and regular army units pitted against students, local townsmen, and people from the nearby hills. So far, two, maybe three are dead, possibly scores injured.
One of those killed, Paul Guyhard, reporter for the French press agency. And how did Meredith adjust to life on campus?
I think I'm learning about as much as I ever did.
How do you characterize their attitude toward you here?
Well, that's their problem, not mine.
Have you been able to concentrate on your classes, Mr. Meredith?
I'm not having any trouble concentrating.
The Mississippi affair was the most violent of several major 1962 integration incidents. In New Orleans, Archbishop Joseph Rummel excommunicated three Catholics who opposed desegregation of parochial schools. In Albany, Georgia, Negroes held prayer meetings on the steps of the city hall to pressure officials to meet with them and discuss desegregation of the community. Charged with attempted insurrection for his alleged part in the Ole Miss rioting was former Major General Edwin Walker, who caused a nationwide furor when he quit the army after charging the military was being suppressed in its attempts to speak out against communism. This led to a months-long congressional investigation, the climax of which came when the general testified.
I was framed in a den of iniquity, represented by coexistence, no win, collaborating, soft on communism, national policy.
The hearing's results, military speech censorship was said to be at worst sometimes capricious and arbitrary, but still necessary. The muzzling probe, as it was called, gained greatest national attention in early April, was soon thereafter crowded off the front pages by news of a government-business confrontation unparalleled since the days of Teddy Roosevelt. For months, the administration had been the third party in Big Steel's labor management contract negotiations, urging restraint, claiming unreasonable wage demands or a price hike would throw the nation's economy in jeopardy. Both sides seemed to agree. In late March, a contract was signed. Labor didn't get wage increases, but fringe benefits were expanded. The administration hailed the contract as non-inflationary, seemed assured there wouldn't be a price hike. But several days later, U.S. Steel announced it was increasing prices $6 a ton. One company after another followed suit, raising prices by the same amount. A dismayed President Kennedy called a news conference.
The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are examining the significance of this action in a free competitive economy. And I am informed that steps are underway by those members of the Congress who plan appropriate inquiries into how these price decisions are so quickly made and reached.
The next day, U.S. Steel's president, Roger Blau, denied he promised the president there'd be no price hike.
We do not question the sincerity of anyone who disagrees with the action we have taken. Neither do we believe that anyone can properly assume that we are less deeply concerned with the welfare, the strength, and the vitality of this nation than are those who have criticized our action.
Meanwhile, the administration was moving with amazing speed to get industry to back down on its decision. Defense contracts were shifted from the big companies to the smaller concerns. High officials made personal phone calls to friends in business. And the big break came on Friday, April the 13th, when Bethlehem Steel reversed its decision. One by one, the other big firms rescinded their increases. A month after this dramatic episode, the stock market took its worst dip since the 1929 crash. Some business quarters blamed it on lack of confidence in the administration's fiscal policy and attitude toward industry. But the government saw it a different way, as expressed by Commerce Secretary Luther Hodges.
People who were investing in the stock market had invested because they thought that the common stocks were a hedge against inflation. That when it came to them, either through this Steel decision or something else, or accumulation thing, that maybe inflation was somewhat under control, maybe that caused stocks to look high in certain cases.
Prices eventually leveled off. The market stabilized. Obituaries this year, The nation lost a woman long associated with unselfish work for the world's betterment, Eleanor Roosevelt. Nobel Prize-winning author William Faulkner died, and violinist Fritz Kreisler. Movie queen Marilyn Monroe shocked the nation when she took an overdose of barbiturates and ended her life. Convicted Soviet spy Robert Soblin fled to Israel, then London, where he took his life after legal efforts to prevent his return to the United States failed. Adolf Eichmann, after a long trial, was executed in Israel for his part in World War II crimes against the Jews. In sports, the San Francisco Giants won the National League pennant by defeating the Los Angeles Dodgers in a playoff, but lost a 7-game World Series to the New York Yankees. And tough guy Sonny Liston captured the world heavyweight boxing crown from Floyd Patterson.
During 1962, the United Nations was sometimes a ringside observer and sometimes a referee in the major world conflicts. But by year's end, the organization was still faced with a problem that has plagued it since its earliest days: money. This is Mel Ligon, Chief of Radio Press International's United Nations Bureau. Despite a majority vote favoring a World Court decision that all members had to pay their dues and special Congo and Middle Eastern expenses, many nations, including all of the Communist bloc and France, reserved the right to refuse to pay. In December, Secretary General U Thant took a long look at the United Nations financial condition and made this comment.
A financially bankrupt United Nations would be an ineffective United Nations if indeed it could survive on such a basis. The financial issue is thus one which, if I may say so, transcends political controversy.
Although it was the continuing problem of bringing peace and stability to the Congo that represented the major drain on the World Organization's pocketbook, it was the Cuban crisis that took center stage in the chambers of the Security Council. In October, the United States quarantined Cuba, and its U.N. Ambassador, Adlai Stevenson, said,
"The United States will not commit aggression against Cuba. But let it be equally clear that the United States will not tolerate aggression against any part of this hemisphere. Cuba has not only armed itself to a degree never before seen in any Latin American country, but it has also welcomed penetration by the foremost exponent of a doctrine condemned in this hemisphere as alien and incompatible."
Replied Cuban President Osvaldo Dorticos,
"We have to warn the United Nations organization today that we are determined to fight. And I wonder and I ask you, gentlemen, whether this blockade against my country is or not an act of war, and if, in view of this fact and event, the United Nations can remain silent."
The verbal battle in the council then hit full stride. During a late-night session, Stevenson and Soviet Ambassador Valerian Zorin engaged in this bitter exchange.
"Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no?"
"I am not in an American courtroom, sir, and therefore I do not wish to answer a question that is put to me in the fashion in which a prosecutor does. In due course, sir, you will have your reply."
"I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision."
Zorin denied the existence of such offensive missiles in Cuba. A few days later, his own government put the lie to him and announced it would remove the weapons from the island. While the United States and Soviet Union were able to agree on at least this, they found themselves on opposite sides of the table over the issue of on-site inspection, of the removal of the missiles and planes, and of possible underground sites. Most vociferous in his refusal to permit such inspection was Fidel Castro, who had suddenly found himself relegated to a non-speaking, non-acting role in the drama. Secretary General U Thant, after a quick visit to Cuba, found Castro in no mood to allow inspectors on the island. Despite the Cuban leader's failure to cooperate, the Soviet Union withdrew its missiles and bombers from Cuba under United States air and sea surveillance. The United States said the surveillance would continue to be shoot weapons into Cuba. With the situation eased, U Thant consented to run for election to a full 5-year term as Secretary General. He was unanimously elected and took the occasion to mark the end of the Cuban crisis.
"In the Cuban crisis, I believe we are now over the most dangerous phase, even though complete agreement on all outstanding aspects has not yet been registered."
Ambassador Stevenson's part in the Cuban crisis was questioned by some in the American press
an action which found other U.N. delegations looking to the President of the United States to give Stevenson a vote of confidence. Mr. Kennedy did this in a letter to his ambassador and then said,
"The fact of the matter is that Governor Stevenson renders very distinguished service, as I have said. He's done an excellent job at the United Nations. I'm surprised that anyone would possibly think that it would be in the interests of the country or the administration or the White House that any lessening of his influence would be provided."
But concern persisted that Mr. Stevenson's effectiveness had been impaired. The world breathed easier with the apparent resolution of the Cuban situation, but it had little time to relax. The Chinese communist invaded India, touching off not only the spark of possible East-West conflict, but igniting the flame of discord between China and Russia. The United Nations, earlier in the year, had closed the door on communist China, refusing it a seat in the world body. Since India chose not to bring the dispute to the World Council, the United Nations maintained a hands-off but watchful position on the border dispute and ensuing negotiations. Virtually buried in the aftermath of the major East-West confrontations during the year was the situation in the Congo. It was and is the settlement of the Congo problem which has kept the United Nations in dire financial straits for the past 2 years. Before the Cuban crisis, Uthant saw fit to note,
"The UN depends on three M's for the peacekeeping operations. There's money, men, and materials. If we don't get these three M's, I think the future of the UN is, if I may say so, quite gloomy."
And at year's end, the central government, endorsed and supported by the United Nations, seemed on the verge of toppling in view of Katanga President Moise Tshombe's reluctance to capitulate. The United Nations played a major role in settling a dispute between Indonesia and the Netherlands over Dutch New Guinea, which threatened to become an Asian battleground. The settlement called for a United Nations-administered territory until a plebiscite is held, which will surely bring it under Indonesian rule. In the same part of the world, and after repeated delays and bloody fighting, a Laotian settlement was reached by negotiators in Geneva. Secretary of State Dean Rusk outlined the key to the settlement, Laotian neutrality.
"This has not been an easy matter. It's been difficult and complicated. But with a great deal of goodwill on all sides, it has been possible to take this next important step in bringing Laos to a position of neutrality and independence."
Also in Geneva, the disarmament talks were on again and off again throughout the year, but failed to reach meaningful agreement. Though members called for a cessation of testing on January 1, 1963, the major powers voiced no pleasure at the decision. The stumbling block was on-site inspection. The major powers did agree on one issue, the peaceful uses of outer space. They realized it was economically wise to cooperate in space exploration, but were unable to find any political grounds for taking the plunge. During the year, the United Nations chambers echoed with clear, unambiguous statements by the Western nations of distrust of the Soviets on Cuba, disarmament, and finances. Such terms as treachery and deception were hurled back and forth. Noting the gap, Secretary General U Thant at the year's end made this appeal.
"No difficult problem can be solved to the complete satisfaction of all sides. We live in an imperfect world and have to accept imperfect solutions, which become more acceptable as we learn to live with them and as time passes by."
Thus, the United Nations closes the year on a note of compromise and accommodation, perhaps foreseeing the trend of world events in 1963.
This is Hank Wilson reporting the events of 1962 in politics. As Congress opened in January, President Kennedy gave the legislators and the nation his goals for the country. In detail, he spelled out his legislative program and added,
"Our nation is commissioned by history to be either an observer of freedom's failure or the cause of its success. Our overriding obligation in the months ahead is to fulfill the world's hopes by fulfilling our own faith."
That it would not be an easy year for the President and Congress was indicated in January even by Senate Democratic leader Mike Mansfield. On the prospects for civil rights legislation, for example, Mansfield declared,
"There is no civil rights legislation on the horizon this year."
Later in the session, Congress managed, after much debate, to pass a bill outlawing poll tax as a voting requisite. On civil rights, Southern filibuster was so prolonged, the Senate imposed cloture, a strict limit on debate, for the first time in 35 years. It was still January when President Kennedy sent his first complete budget to Congress, one calling for record defense spending but allowing for a small budget surplus. Democrats hailed it while Republicans criticized what they called extravagance. Typical was the analysis of Senate Republican leader Everett Dirksen.
The cost of government is going to increase to $92.5 billion. The size of the government is, of course, going to grow in commensurate fashion.
And by the end of the year, instead of surplus, the outlook was for a deficit of billions of dollars. One of the early White House measures sent to Capitol Hill was a bill to establish a Department of Urban Affairs at the cabinet level. Opposed from several quarters, strongest objections came from Southern and Republican members of Congress. For one thing, the president had announced he would appoint Robert Weaver, a Negro, to head the department. Weaver himself came out for it.
Being in a cabinet situation, the department head would be much better able to articulate the needs for housing and urban development than he is now.
But House Republican leader Charles Halleck retorted,
"We submit that rather than a maneuver to put Republicans on the spot with respect to civil rights, the real purpose of Mr. Kennedy's move is to take Democrats off the spot."
And the Urban Affairs Bill was defeated. But important parts of the administration's legislative program did pass. A big one, the measure giving the president authority to make broad tariff cuts on imported goods. Support was bipartisan. Commerce Secretary Luther Hodges had stumped long and hard for passage of the Reciprocal Trade Act.
This bill is one of the most important pieces of legislation to have come before the Congress in the last decade. The time has come to write a new and basic charter for the conduct of our international economic affairs, especially our trade. The Trade Expansion Act of 1962 is that charter.
For some time, there had been cries for an overall reform of the tax structure. Problem was, everyone had a different idea of what needed to be reformed. Internal Revenue Director Mortimer Kaplan declared,
"The average taxpayer will not have to go into the minutiae of detail in figuring out his depreciation. I think this is something to be applauded, and I have great confidence that the legislation will be adopted and that we'll put in our depreciation reform before the summer."
Congress passed the tax reform, and by the end of the year, a tax cut for next year appeared likely. Other measures that passed, the retraining of workers displaced of their jobs by automation. Foreign aid underwent the usual criticism, then passed. The Kennedy Farm Program was enacted, but in a form undiscernible from the original. In the Senate, two of the president's favorites, Arthur Goldberg and Byron Whizzer White, won quick nomination to the bench of the Supreme Court. Perhaps the most publicized of the Kennedy program was medical care for the aged under Social Security. The president was confident the bill would pass.
"This year we shall pass, I believe. We shall pass medical care for the aged by the Social Security. And I'm confident that the great majority, in fact, all doctors, will treat those who may be covered by this national program."
Greatest opposition came from the American Medical Association, officials of which called it the first step toward socialized medicine. AMA President Dr. Leonard Larson insisted,
"Giant Madison Square Garden rallies cannot conceal this fact. The radical King Anderson proposal would give the federal government dangerous power to control medical practice in hospitals."
Medicare was defeated in the Senate 52-48. Still another touchy one, federal aid to education also failed. Primary reason, the question of whether or not private and parochial schools should be included. Throughout the session, Congress was busy on a number of fronts. One committee spent weeks on the Billy Saul Estes scandal. Another, probing practices of goods packaging, heard Food and Drug Administrator George Lerich testify,
"This table shows 105 seizure actions due to short weight or short volume, and 28 seizures because of net content statements or ingredient statements printed so that they could not be read except with the aid of a magnifying glass."
The congressional elections in November brought some changes in membership of both houses, but little prospect for easing difficulties for the president's goals. Most publicized, John Kennedy's youngest brother, Ted, elected United States Senator from Massachusetts.
I pledge that I shall dedicate all of my strength and will to serving you in the United States Senate.
The Republicans either elected or re-elected three governors that well may compete for the 1964 GOP presidential nomination. Nelson Rockefeller in New York.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've laid the foundation. Now let's build in the 4 years that lie ahead, and let's really take this state where it ought to be. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
William Scranton in Pennsylvania.
Needless to say, I am so grateful and so indebted to all of the people of Pennsylvania that I hardly know where to begin.
And industrialist George Romney in Michigan.
Why don't we go home and prepare to rejoice in the results of a great campaign, and one that has involved a dedication on the part of citizens that exceeds anything in the history of this state.
While in the far West, it was the end of the political road for Richard M. Nixon, defeated for governor of California.
As I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
The missiles that played major roles in the East-West confrontation over Cuba also placed men in orbit and sent equipment to distant planets in 1962. And while man saw himself holding the key to both his future and his destruction, he found himself unable, in many cases, to elude the whims of nature. This is Christopher Glenn reporting the year's developments in space and science and reviewing the man-made and natural disasters that made news in 1962. The year found the Soviet Union maintaining an impressive lead over the United States in manned orbital flights. During a 24-hour period in mid-August, the Soviets placed two men into similar orbits, so similar, in fact, that they were able to see each other. The first of the space twins to go into orbit was Andrian Nikolaev in Vostok 3. This is what he sounded like as he reported back to Earth. Just over 23 hours later, Pavel Popovich in Vostok 4 was placed in an orbit that brought him within sight of Nikolaev. These two men traveled millions of miles in space concurrently and spent a total of more than 160 hours in space. Despite the Soviet achievement, President Kennedy, in an address delivered in Houston's Rice Stadium, said,
"No nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space. And this generation does not intend to founder in the backwash of the coming age of space. We mean to be a part of it. We mean to lead it."
Then the president charted the free world's first goal in space.
"We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept and one we intend to win, and the others too."
Earlier in the year, after repeated delays, the United States launched its first astronaut into orbit.
5, 4, 3,
ignition.
2, 1, 0, ignition. Liftoff. The MA-6
launch vehicle screams high into the sky with all five engines pouring out.
Colonel John Glenn, a 40-year-old Marine pilot, rode his Mercury capsule three times around the Earth. As soon as he entered orbit, Colonel Glenn commented on weightlessness and the view.
"Zero G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous. Roger, turnaround has started. Capsule turning around, and I could see the booster during turnaround just a couple of hundred yards behind me. It was beautiful. Suspension 7, I can see clear back a big cloud pattern way back across toward the Cape. Beautiful sight."
3 months later, astronaut Malcolm Carpenter duplicated Glenn's flight, although his recovery was complicated by his overshooting the landing spot by some 250 miles. Then in October, Commander Walter Schirra took his Mercury capsule on a six-orbit flight around the world. On his return, he summed up his flight this way.
The overall flight, I thought, was a textbook flight. We've had problems in the past, and they've been solved.
Next spring, Gordon Cooper will take a 24-hour journey through space. Despite the Soviet lead, National Aeronautics and Space Administration Chief James Webb maintained,
"My own belief is that the bringing to bear through the resources that the government is applying, the utilization of those resources to mobilize industry will give us a position satisfactory to the United States. Now, whether you say, will we be ahead with respect to some specific kind of an event, I think we will make the manned lunar landing and return before they do."
In addition to men, missiles hurled satellites and space vehicles into orbit. The two most spectacular of these were Telstar, the communications satellite, and Mariner 2, the Venus probe. The Mariner flew to within 21,000 miles of Venus, turned on its equipment, and sent back information on the planet across 36 million miles of space. As East and West rejoiced in man's progress in conquering space, they found common ground in sharing the tragedy that befell many newborn babies around the world. Thalidomide, a drug used in a tranquilizer marketed in Europe, was found to be the prime cause of deformities in infants. Although some thalidomide was distributed on this continent, it was never sold in the United States because of the vigilance of a Canadian-born researcher in the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Francis O. Kelsey, who told a congressional committee of the obstacles she had to overcome to ban thalidomide.
There was a great difference of opinion amongst workers there as to whether this really was related to the drug. And this didn't only apply to members of the firm that made the drug, but to physicians and clinicians. They were unwilling to immediately assume this relationship as being a causal one. To establish beyond fairly reasonable doubt was quite difficult.
For her work, Dr. Kelsey was honored by the President of the United States. While man found himself able to master space in 1962, he was frustrated in many of his attempts to harness the forces of nature. In January, an avalanche of ice and snow buried two villages, 14 settlements, and more than 3,000 people under a mile-wide sheet of 40-foot-deep snow and ice at the foot of Mount Huascuan in Peru. Less than 2 months later, an Atlantic coast storm deluged six states along the United States' eastern seaboard, taking almost 50 lives and causing millions of dollars in damages. The year also had its share of major accidents in the air, at sea, and on land. Among them were these: all 95 passengers and crew killed on takeoff in the crash of a jetliner bound from New York to Los Angeles in March. A 707 jet disintegrated in the air over Iowa in May, killing 45. 111 people crashed to their death in a jet in the French West Indies in June. And if any one air accident can be more tragic than another, it must surely have been the crash of a jetliner in a Paris suburb in June. All 130 aboard were killed, most of them leaders of the Atlanta, Georgia cultural community. The man who chartered the flight was the director of the Atlanta Art Association, Dr. Reginald Poland.
"This great tragedy has taken more than 120 lives of the leaders of the cultural and social life of Atlanta. There are no words to describe the loss."
Europe's worst rail disaster occurred in Holland at the beginning of the year as two trains collided, killing 87. In February, West Germany's safest coal mine in the Saar area caved in, taking about 300 lives. And in December, 37 miners lost their lives hundreds of feet underground in Carmichael's, Pennsylvania. Despite these setbacks, 1962 was a year in which man took important steps toward expanding his horizons.
These were the events and the people that captured the imagination and attention of the world during 1962. While there were pluses and minuses for both East and West during the year, the ultimate victory belonged to mankind, for it showed enough sense not to destroy itself. And it starts the new year on a note of better understanding and hope for peace, based on the experiences of 1962, Year in Review.